This is going to be an enormous credit crunch. The party is over for the United States. We cannot continue borrowing to live beyond our means and consuming foreign products.
It's you must be a left right at a party.
Huh? No, I'm pretty fun at parties. Okay.
Hi, and welcome to NPR's Planet Money. I'm Adam Davidson.
And I'm Laura Conaway. Today is Friday, thank goodness, November 21st. It's about 4:45 p.m. here in New York City. Do you know who your Treasury Secretary is?
It looks like we do. It hasn't been officially announced, but NPR is reporting that Barack Obama offered the job, and Tim Geithner, the president of the New York Fed, said yes. This just happened as we were preparing the podcast, and we'll certainly talk more about it next week. But
do we have a nugget on him now?
Yeah, I mean, Tim Geithner has been the man at the Federal Reserve really dealing with this crisis.
Oh, good.
The New York Fed, the Fed is broken up into 12 reserve banks around the country, plus it has obviously the headquarters in Washington, D.C. But the Federal Reserve Bank in New York is the main interaction between the Fed and the financial markets. It is Tim Geithner who has really been driving things.
Yeah.
Under the leadership of Ben Bernanke, but on a day-to-day basis, my sense is Tim Geithner has been much more in the front lines.
So we're looking at some continuity here.
We are looking at continuity, and we're looking at a guy who most people on Wall Street seem to really like. It is interesting to me because many of the other names that we heard, like Larry Summers or Bob Rubin, Larry Summers is a serious, important economist. Tim Geithner is not an economist. Tim Geithner is, you know, very well known to Wall Street, but he's not like Henry Paulson or Bob Rubin, a Wall Street player. His career has mostly been public service, and I think he worked at the Council on Foreign Relations at one point, but not an actual trader. I think this will get mixed reviews. It already has, actually, from the quick look I saw. A lot of people are thrilled. They say, oh, okay, that's continuity. He really knows what he's doing. Other people say, hey, look, what the Fed and Treasury have been doing so far hasn't worked all that great, and he's too political. He's too he's not a Paul Volcker type, a brave guy who's just going to do the right thing no matter what. Tim Geithner might be, depending on your perspective, might be someone who's going to look to please more people than maybe we want. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying these are the things I've read. But we will talk about this much more and learn a lot more.
Can we call him our Planet Money Indicator today?
Let's do another quick Planet Money Indicator, which is the fact that the Dow Jones Industrial Average hurtled up the second they learned that Tim Geithner would be Treasury Secretary. Yeah, I mean, usually when the Dow – see, this is the danger of using the Dow Jones Industrial Average as an indicator because you really don't know. It's just millions of people making billions of decisions, and then there's a number. And I'm not persuaded that we can always know what the source of that move is or that there is one source, although this is striking. The Dow traded mostly pretty close to flat today. People learn that Tim Geithner is going to be Treasury Secretary and just, boom, shoots up like a rocket, rose 500 points. Although one of my favorite economic blogs, Naked Capitalist, said that if they had named Paul Volcker, it would have gone up by 1,000 points. So I guess we'll never know. But, I will see where it goes next week. But at least for today, at least to some degree, stock market folks were happy.
All right. So we're going to be talking a lot today about where the economy is going. We have a very cool visit coming up from this guy named Peter Schiff, who was right and who has some very scary things to say next. Meanwhile, I have a listener who checked in today from Denver. Her name is Christine Wallravens, and she says she wonders whether the recession might have a silver lining for the planet.
Despite all the other appeals from other countries in the world, we have not made many efforts to help with global warming. The only thing that seemed to start helping was when the price of oil went way up. People finally started turning in their SUVs, riding bikes, and using public transportation. So I'm wondering, with that or I've noticed there's less demand for oil now and fewer new housing starts. There also seems to be a movement that more people are going to thrift stores and being less consumeristic, which might help with global warming also.
I went to an actuary of all people for an answer. Gail Tverberg of Atlanta is also a frequent contributor to a blog called The Oil Drum.
Tverberg has a very particular view of the oil economy. It's one that is very popular on the internet and one I'm not, I got to be honest, particularly persuaded by. It's called the peak oil theory. Now, we all know, of course, that oil is a limited resource. There's only so much out there. You know, a lot of people say, yeah, but we keep discovering new deposits and there's more deposits all along and it'll last a while. The peak oil folks say, no, we've pretty much discovered all the oil we're going to discover and it's only downhill from here and pretty soon we're going to have a post-oil economy. And that's
her, peak oil. Yeah.
That's peak oil.
Tverberg says Christine is on to something about the economic crisis and global warming.
No, I think that's definitely the case. All of the forecasts that were put together assume fairly big ramp-ups in use of oil and natural gas and coal and such things. And the fact that we're having a recession, in fact, results in our using less, and so that will help the global warming issue, the carbon dioxide issue that everyone is concerned about. We're actually, the percentage we're down on gasoline is quite a bit less than we're down on, say, diesel and airline fuel, surprisingly. But it's of the order of magnitude of, we'll say, 5% less. It's down a little. It's not down by 25%, we'll say.
Will the economic downturn, in your opinion, slow any of the efforts to develop alternative sources of fuel?
I think we're seeing quite a bit of that. The alternatives tend to be very expensive, and so the economic downturn has brought down the price of oil and the price of a lot of other things. So what happens is the alternatives look like a very poor investment compared to the oil or whatever with these lower prices. And also, there's less credit availability now, and these alternatives used a lot of credit. So it's really given them a double hit.
I want to note, too, that Tverberg doesn't like alternative energy much better than fossil fuels. She says that making the alternative stuff uses a lot of fossil fuels and that we're all just going to need to use less, like riding bikes.
Speaking of very particular views, we had another great visitor today. Peter Schiff stopped by the office. Maybe you've heard of him. So there's this really awesome video that I've enjoyed watching. Laura, I know you enjoyed watching it. We've all here at Planet Money been enjoying it. It's a video of Peter Schiff, a money manager, a market commentator, warning over and over again exactly what would happen in this financial crisis, except he had the poor taste of warning it at the height of the bubble on CNBC and Fox News and CNN. And this video is just other market experts laughing at him, making fun of him, calling him the Grinch and just absolutely making him seem like the biggest moron in the world for suggesting in 2006 and 2007 that there's even the slightest chance of a downturn in the housing market or a broader financial crisis or a recession. Actually, let's just play it. I've been describing it too long.
Peter,
most of the profits that people have in real estate are going to vanish, just like the profits in the dot-coms in 1999, 2000. It's a fantasy. People can't sell their house. The inventories are exploding all over the country. Houses are on the market for 6 months a year. There's no bidders. So, the price is going to fall through the floor. You guys are deluding yourself.
We heard it loud and clear.
I don't know if you heard in the background a guy laughing, saying, so what? This is just one of dozens of examples. So it makes me very happy to say sitting right next to me is Peter Schiff. Hi.
Hi. I did hundreds of these interviews, and people were calling me things like a communist. You know, people would roll their eyes at me. You know, they would snicker. They would laugh. It was common. It's not just the few people in these clips. There's a whole bunch of clips.
The other thing that strikes me from these videos is you just look kind of calm. You don't look flustered. You don't look – actually, everyone else seems like you threw a grenade in the room and they're screaming at you and they're all exercised. You're just sitting there going – you just keep talking and you don't raise your voice and you just say, no, no, this is what's going to happen. What was that like sitting in these studios?
I did it so many times, I got used to it. You know, when they first started calling me Dr. Doom on CNBC, I think it was back in mid-2004. And, you know, but I knew that I was right. I knew that I had the facts and truth on my side. And I think the reason other people reacted this way is because, you know, they didn't want to hear it. They're living inside this bubble and they don't want to entertain the idea that maybe they're wrong, that maybe things are not as good as they believe. And so they just tune it out. And when someone tries to point it out, they just respond with ridicule or with laughter. But for me, it was easy to be calm because I understood what was going on.
Now, we were having a talk in the office where someone said, oh, but anytime there's a financial panic or a financial problem, you can always find someone who is pessimistic. Is he really that special? And I said, well, what makes me really give Peter Schiff, you, more credence, is you were very specific about this, the precise nature of the problem. You were saying that all of the growth, most of the growth between 2002 and 2007 was fueled by debt.
Exactly.
That went into houses that were overpriced.
It was borrowed prosperity. I mean, it wasn't legitimate. We simply borrowed money principally from foreigners, and we spent it all. We spent it on building homes, on remodeling homes, on buying SUVs and plasma TVs and iPods and all the gadgets and trinkets. And as consumption became a bigger and bigger part of our GDP, we kept assuming that our economy was growing. But all that was growing was our debt. And we pretended that the debt was manageable because we related it to the value of our homes and to the value of our stocks. But we didn't realize that those were bubbles and the wealth was phony, but the debts were real. And especially the fact that a lot of the people who were borrowing using teaser rates and other gimmicks that temporarily kept the interest payments low. But I knew that it would only be a matter of time before these rates reset and we couldn't afford to pay the interest. And once the asset bubbles burst, we'd be broke.
Did you have a moment, Peter, when you got it?
I think I've always gotten it. I don't know. I think I've had an understanding of Austrian economics, and I understand the difference between, you know, real production and consumption. I understand that economies grow as a result of savings, not as a result of spending. I mean, we've got the cart before the horse here. We think the key to economic growth is people spending money. But the only reason we're able to spend money is because there's real economic growth happening outside the United States where people are saving money that we're able to borrow and they're producing all this stuff that we're able to consume.
But you're saying there's a change coming, that the bottom is going to fall out, and you're saying this at the height of a bubble.
Sure. I think what's going on right now, you know, the financial crisis that we're seeing, this is a real economic crisis. And what's happening right now is not the problem. What's happening now is the consequence of the problem. And the problem was, for years, we borrowed too much money. We borrowed trillions of dollars. And rather than investing that money and building up our industrial capacity so we can actually pay back the money we borrowed, we simply spent the money. And now we don't have the means to pay it back. And so what's happening now is our whole phony service sector economy, which grew up around all this borrowing and spending, is toppling because it's really not viable. And what's happening now is we have to transition from this borrow and spend economy to a save and produce economy, like everybody else. And it's a very painful process. Asset prices fall. People lose their jobs. People go broke. This is the natural consequence. But this is the solution. We need to accept that and stop trying to recreate the phony bubble economy that's burst. But that's what government is trying to do. That's what the stimulus and the bailouts are all about. They want to get Americans back to the mall, spending more money, but that's the root cause of the problem.
I just want to explain to our listeners, you are not simply a one other market observer who is looking at data tables and some Excel spreadsheet and drawing different conclusions. You come from a very strong, I don't know if I want to say intellectual or ideological perspective. The Austrian school, when we talk about the Austrian school, we're talking about a very specific approach to economics. It's most associated with Friedrich Hayek,
yes.
Hayek and Ludwig von Mises.
It's a laissez-faire. It's as opposed to a Keynesianist or monetarist. It's just another school of thought, which I think is right.
So I just want to place you on sort of the political map. If we place you on the political map, you are in that part of the political map that is very strongly libertarian, that thinks that there is a very limited role for government in an economy.
Precisely. And we understand that all the things, all the Keynesian tools that are now being used to fight the recession actually make the problems worse because they delay the free market's attempts to correct from the malinvestments of the boom, and they actually make the situation worse. That's exactly what happened during the 1930s. Both Hoover and Roosevelt interfered in the free market and created the Great Depression. And it's very scary that the people in power now think that Roosevelt got us out of the Depression.
Now, I know a lot of Austrian school people, so I'm not shocked, but I think the average listener might be shocked to hear the idea that Roosevelt, FDR, created the Great Depression. I mean, I think popular imagination in America, Roosevelt ended the Great Depression.
Well, he didn't create it. He inherited it from Hoover. But we wouldn't have had it if Hoover had not intervened so substantially
in
the
economy. But that Roosevelt worsened it, that he didn't
did.
Help. That's
yes.
the Austrian school's
He did
view.
Worsen it. In fact, the depth of the Depression happened during the Roosevelt term. And it wouldn't have lasted nearly as long if the government had stayed out of the way. But if you want to get back to the roots of the Depression, it was an asset bubble that the newly created Federal Reserve blew up in the 1920s in the stock market. It burst, and rather than letting the free market work, which Hoover was advised to do, he did not do that, and he intervened every way he could, and he screwed the economy up. And that's exactly what Bush is doing now, and Paulson, and that's exactly what Obama is promising. That's why we are in the process of creating another Great Depression.
So what's your own exit plan here? It sounds like you think we're heading straight for the bottom.
Look, I think we're in serious, serious trouble. I think this is just the beginning of a major shift in the global economy. We're not going to be the leaders anymore. The world is not going to do our bidding. They're not going to lend us money to consume. They're not going to ship us goods that we can't afford to pay for, which means we're going to have a big decline in our standard of living. And unless Obama comes to terms with the real cause of these problems and does a 180-degree change in the policies that he's going to pursue, as I said, we're going to create a massive, massive depression. Until we come to terms with what's really going on, we're just going to make the problems worse.
Peter Schiff, thank you very much. Like everyone who has interviewed you over the last several years, I sincerely hope you are wrong about everything, but it's increasingly difficult to assume that's the case. Well, thank you very much.
At least you're not laughing. You don't have to worry about the YouTube clip in a few years.
Right. Yeah, for YouTube in 2012. Well, Peter, I think you're exactly right.
Clearly.
Thank you to Peter Schiff for stopping by. After we talked, I asked a colleague of ours, Deputy National Desk Editor Uri Berliner, to sit down and answer a few questions. So it's easy to beat up on CNBC and Fox News, but I thought it would be worth seeing how we at NPR did. And I asked Uri Berliner to come in. Hi, Uri.
Hi, Adam.
Hey, so you were my boss during the housing bubble. You were,
right.
You were, I guess, during this whole bubble period, you were one of NPR's two business editors.
Absolutely.
You're now the number two guy on the national desk, so you got a promotion.
Right.
And so I was a business reporter for mm-hmm. much of right. the housing bubble. How did we do?
Well, I think we did pretty well in saying that there was a housing bubble and that it was going to burst and it wasn't going to be pretty. What we didn't do, which I don't know that any news organization did, was to connect everything and say that there was going to be this toxic plume that basically poisons the financial system and that it was all related to housing and in particular to this subprime housing mess. So we reported as early as the 2005-2006 that there was a real estate bubble out there and it was going to end in a bad way. But we didn't say, and it's going to bring down the entire global economy. And I don't know that any news organization was out there saying that.
So what should we do now? What are we? You're still very much in the mix of editing business stories and thinking about our business coverage. I've found this week, in a way, a frustrating week because in the height of the crisis in September and October, lots of disturbing, weird things were happening, but on any given day, it kind of seemed clear what the story was. This week, my head hurts trying to figure out what's the core story. We have the auto bailout. We have the resurgence of a financial crisis. We have President-elect Obama's economic team trying to figure out who's going to be on it, what's going to happen. We have Treasury saying we're going to take a pass on any future actions for a little while. the Fed doubling its balance sheet, and we're going to define what that means next week, actually. I just arranged an interview. It almost makes your head hurt. It makes my head hurt just thinking about all of it.
I'm with you. My head hurts, too. I guess we got a double headache.
Yeah.
But I think all of that, what you just described, and as well as this recession spreads out from Wall Street as it continues to into the rest of the country, the impact on jobs, the impact on spending and people's day-to-day lives has to be increasingly affected. I think that's what we want to be covering very closely.
Well, thank you very much, Uri. Uri Berliner, your deputy national desk editor, is that your proper title? Yes. All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Adam.
Adam, let's call it a week.
I am looking forward to the rest this weekend.
Yeah, me too. I'm Laura Conaway. You guys come find us on the blog. We're at npr.org/money. Keep those questions coming. Keep those photos coming. Keep those stories coming. And thank you.
I'm Adam Davidson. Next week, what is money? Thank you for listening.